Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Our case for argument is Khan v. Fatima. Mr. Giglio.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Brad Giglio of Mavora Law Offices. I represent Tarfa Fatima, the respondent appellant in this matter. The petitioner under Article 3 of this Hague Convention failed to meet their burden by failing to prove that he had custody rights and at the time of removal actually was exercising those rights. If you look at the transcript from pages 10 through 22, at no point does counsel for the petitioner present any Canadian law that needed to be...
Wasn't that presented in the petition itself?
It was presented in the petition. However, the counsel never, during the hearing, presented it to be admitted into evidence, never asked the court to consider it, never argued it.
Was that objection made at the time?
Well, there was no objection to be made because they had not asked the court.
Did you say that they had failed to show custody?
I did argue, yes, Your Honor, that the court, that they failed to show that he was exercising custody at the time of the removal.
So your position is that the court could not consider the sworn submissions that were part of the petition?
My position is that counsel should have presented them during the hearing so we had then had an opportunity to object and to challenge the authenticity and to present contrary evidence.
Well, there wasn't anything that stopped you from presenting contrary evidence, was there?
But I suppose it did not, but it's not our burden at that point. It's their burden to show under the Canadian law that he was exercising custody. It's especially noteworthy.
Is there any doubt that he was exercising custody at the time the children were removed in India?
Absolutely, Judge. He specifically testified on page 15, I did not have custody of the child at that point. He conceded to it. He admitted to it on the record.
Well, physical possession of the child, right?
Well, that's you know, a cause of argument. He later on said that he still had custody at the time of the hearing, but never did he clarify that he actually had custody at that point. And it's also significant because prior to removal, he abandoned the child. He got into a car to go to the airport to leave the child in India. He testified he was going to Canada without this child. And noteworthy as well is he still had possession of the passport of that child, which means he was stranding this child in India. He was getting in a car.
Is that the way he described this?
Yes, Your Honor. His testimony, he was in a car headed to Canada without the minor child. And the later testimony was that after being stopped by the police, he was ordered to tender the passport, which he then did.
Where are the children now?
SFK, the... six-month-old, is with my client in Bolingbrook, and the ZFK, the three-year-old, is in the petitioner's custody. The SFK was born in Illinois, is a U.S. citizen.
So the three-year-old is living with her father?
Under this court's order, and only pursuant to
Chicago or some...
I believe in a hotel in Chicago as represented by counsel. But it's... So they failed to shift the burden. They failed to show that he was actually exercising custody. And had they presented Canadian law, and specifically the case I had cited, AMRI versus KER, the conduct of the petitioner in this case was inconsistent with return of the child.
Is he here alone or with his parents?
The petitioner?
Yeah.
I do not know the answer to that. But by their failure to present and even argue Canadian law, at the time they were trying to prove their prima facie case, and there was no application of Canadian law by the district court in its finding on page 22 that the judge was even considering Canadian law in its finding. And what's more, the judge only found domicile. The judge didn't even make a finding of exercising custody.
What's the bearing of Canadian law?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
What's the bearing of Canadian, relevance of Canadian law?
Well, under the opinion in Henri Adan, under the Third Circuit, Canadian law must be considered when determining under Article 3 whether the petitioner had a right of custody and was exercising it at the moment of removal. And then the only testimony that was put in by the petitioner in trying to prove their prima facie case was evidence from Canada. They didn't put any evidence in from India where they were, which is where the removal took place, that he was exercising custody in India. And he specifically said he did not have custody and he had tried to leave the country without this child.
But he was being charged with illegal activity in India, wasn't he? Isn't that why he left?
Well, he was being charged, He hadn't yet been formally charged. He was being investigated for cruelty to his spouse under the dowry charge.
So he left India, presumably, to avoid getting entrapped in the Indian legal system.
Exactly, Judge. And it's that blatant disregard of...
Well, he didn't get out.
He did not get out. But the act of trying to leave is, in and of itself, abandonment. I mean, he tried to leave his three, then two-and-a-half-year-old, in India.
So under what circumstances was he allowed to leave India? Did the Indian government decide not to prosecute him or what?
No, Your Honor. That case is still pending. The petitioner even filed a separate cause to try and get that charge dismissed. And I have a certified copy showing that they denied his
charge. But he wasn't arrested, is that it, so he could leave?
No, he was arrested. The charge is pending.
How was he allowed to leave?
That's a good question. The information I have that's not in the record shows that there's still a warrant out, but I haven't been able to get a certified copy of that document yet. But all the records, and it's undisputed, that the charges are still pending against him in India, that he tried to get him dismissed, and they denied it. So those charges are still facing him, which, again, we would argue under the principles and the purpose of The Hague is forum shopping on behalf of the petitioner. He lost custody.
Forum shopping, I understand.
Because in his own testimony, he testified that he lost custody, that the police...
He lives in India. I mean, he's a Canadian.
Right? Correct, Judge. But he testified that under Indian law, the wife gets custody with those charges pending. And so without resolving that case where his own testimony says he doesn't have custody, he comes back to Canada to try and use Canadian law without even resolving the India case that's still pending. But I think the crux of it is the Hague Convention was not put in place. This particular convention was not put in place to award a remedy to someone who tried to abandon this child and strand them in India, another country on another continent, to only come back here to say, oh, you didn't get stranded, you were empowered enough to break free from my abuse and go to the U.S.
How could he have taken her back to Canada with him, the child?
Well, he could have tried to contact the child in India, which there's no evidence he did before he left.
No.
Or the mother of the child to try and see the child.
Yeah, but the mother wasn't going to give her child up to him.
Well, we don't know that.
It's
pretty obvious. No, look, I think this is all a side issue. I think the big issue is, you know, does the child face a grave psychological risk if she's returned to him in Canada, right? Isn't that the big issue?
Well, it's not the only issue, because if he's not exercising custody...
I consider to be serious. So why don't you address that issue?
Yes, Your Honor. Looking at the petitioner's actions and the evidence here, the evidence presented was pretty black and white. You either have the petitioner's testimony itself, or you have all the other witnesses and all the other testimony that came in. So I know it's difficult, and
the contradictions in her testimony, and he has contrary testimony.
Yes.
Did the judge resolve any of these testimonial disagreements?
No.
That's the problem, isn't it?
There were several errors.
We don't have any findings, do we? Do we have any findings?
From the district judge? The only findings is that it basically a blanket, the respondent did not meet her burden. But there's no factual findings of who was telling the truth or who wasn't. Like when the petitioner...
I thought he made it pretty clear that he couldn't tell who was telling the truth and that meant there wasn't clear and convincing evidence of grave risk.
The judge's words were, it's a he said, she said.
Mm-hmm.
But the facts brought out and the judge's failure to consider a lot of the facts and even specifically misstating what was presented is an error.
Did he actually make a credibility finding?
No. The court said it's a he said, she said, and did not make credibility findings of which witness was telling the truth, which witness was not, which witness was more believable versus the other. He essentially
I don't think I've ever seen a case where a judge said, I can't figure out who's lying and who's telling the truth, so I'm just going to dismiss your case, right?
I was.
This amounts to.
It does, Judge, but
I've never seen that. I mean, I usually think, you know, judges have to do their best to figure out who's telling the truth, and
Isn't this similar to an acquittal in a bench trial in a criminal case? You don't need specific findings. You've got a very high burden of proof on this affirmative defense of grave risk. And the judge was not convinced that it was met.
But the court needs to make specific findings upon which it's going to base a decision with such gravity as this. I mean, you have the petitioner's testimony that, I mean, for the petitioner to be telling the truth, you'd have to have his confession to the India police thrown out, the testimony by Mr. Syed of three specific instances of his rage thrown out, that the child saying she's scared of him thrown out, that the child saying he hurt her thrown out, Farina Fatima's testimony of his rage thrown out, and Tarfa's testimony, along with the two supervisors who personally observed this child and were gravely concerned.
So, you're in your rebuttal.
All right, thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Giglio. Ms. Seaworth?
May it please the Court. I'm sort of taken aback by some of the statements from my opposing attorney. First of all, the burden to present a 13B defense is squarely on the respondent. And to say that the judge made no findings as to how he had presented his material and reached that burden, I think is a total misrepresentation. The judge
I don't think I've ever seen a transcript of a hearing quite as empty as this. I don't know what did the judge say. I didn't seem to say anything. He's got like one page of discussion, and where are his findings? I don't see any findings.
The findings he made were, A, as Mr. Giglio stated, this was a he said, she said hearing.
And
pardon?
Can't hear. You have to speak up.
I'm sorry. I thought I was.
I mean, he says these strange things. I haven't handled any family court matters in virtually forever, it seems. But certainly since I've been on the bench here, and I handled very few when I was in practice, now I don't know what. I don't know. If I was probably sitting in Canada, I probably would award the child to the mother because of the age of the child. And there's always some risk, and on he goes. But I don't see any finding. The witnesses disagreed.
Your Honor,
what would you point to as
his
whether Mr. Khan grabbed the child and jerked her arm or did something like that, I don't know. There's really no evidence that he did, but then he says, the judge says, there is evidence that she complained about some hurt. The witness was very speculative.
That was the...
So what were we... What?
All right, the finding that the...
He's afraid to make findings because he figured he doesn't know anything about domestic relations, so...
But he wasn't deciding a domestic relations case, Your Honor.
Oh, yes, he was.
He was not deciding a custody case.
Well, this is a domestic relations case if you ever saw it. King Solomon should be here.
Okay. It was not a
state domestic relations case.
Correct. It was not a divorce case.
It's a domestic relations
case. Okay. I stand corrected.
Yeah.
What the judge said, he made, I think, a key finding.
And just following up on Judge Bauer's point, of course, what we know about domestic relations is the two sides, they say the opposite thing. They drive the judge crazy. But the judge has to make a finding, you know? So she says one thing, her husband says another, and he has to decide who's more credible. And I don't see where he did that.
He says he can't do it.
Can't do it, right?
And I don't think that necessarily was the task he was supposed to fulfill. The respondent here, Tarfa Fatima, had the obligation to present clear and convincing evidence of a 13B defense. And she spent hours testifying as to
insults and other things that she thought had occurred to her.
But if the judge said, I don't believe you, I think you're lying, fine. But he didn't say that. What I get out of it, he can't make up his mind because he feels uncomfortable in a domestic relation setting because he has no experience with it.
But he did make up his mind. What he said was, if in terms of the physical abuse that was claimed in the case, what he said was, there is a possibility of a bruise on Miss Fatima's arm. If Mr. Khan did that, that was wrong, but it was short of a grave risk. There's his finding, that all of the material she presented, and this one which involved the trip to the India police station, in which the cycle of arrest and no charge began, that all of that testimony was the key piece that was presented at the hearing, because it was the one piece of evidence that one side said there was physical abuse and the other side said there was not.
And he said he couldn't make up his mind.
No, he said that whatever the testimony was, it did not rise to the level of a grave risk.
But he seemed to think that the only grave risk is if you have real injury.
Well, that's...
The concern is psychological. And he didn't discuss the psychological evidence. Also, he did something else that's odd, I think. He said that no citizen of Illinois was before the no resident of Illinois was before the court.
That's true.
But she's a resident of Illinois.
Well, she is an official resident of Canada who happens to be in Illinois.
She's a citizen of the United States, and she's living in Illinois.
That's right, but she took permanent residency in Canada.
Right now, she's a resident in Illinois. She's a citizen. She doesn't want to go back to Canada. No one can force her to go back to Canada, right?
That's right.
You think Illinois could say, oh, you're not a permanent resident, so we're sending you back to Canada? That's ridiculous.
But
she's an American citizen. She can live anywhere she wants in the United States.
Your Honor, the point is not sending her back. The whole Hague Convention deals only with the child.
There are no residents of Illinois before me.
I have no idea.
But that's a mistake, and it's a serious mistake, because what he's really saying is, this isn't my business, this is Canada's business.
It is
Canada's business.
He doesn't
seem to realize she's a citizen of the United States, living in the United States. She has a right to invoke the aid of a federal court, right?
Absolutely. But the whole Hague Convention...
He seems to think that. He seems there's no business her being here because she's not a resident.
The focus of the Hague Convention is on the return of the child, the mother or the...
I'm worried about a judge who says... He's very uncomfortable. He doesn't want to make findings in a case like this. He's not comfortable with domestic relations, which is fine because federal judges have very little dealing with domestic relations. But he seems to think that it's Canada's business. He has no business with it because there's no American in front of him. See, that's what's disturbing about it.
Well,
that makes it easy for him to say, what are you doing here? No Americans here. You're all Canadians. Go back there, right?
Your Honor, I think that was a toss-off remark.
No, I think it was a mistake. I don't see it a tossed-off remark. Where's the tossed-off remark?
The point of the whole Hague Convention case was where the custody litigation was to take place. It has nothing to do with the mother's citizenship or where she happens to be living. The point of the litigation is that the child was the habitual resident of Canada, that Mr. Khan had custodial rights under the law of Canada, and he was exercising those rights at the time of the wrongful removal. Now, you asked a question earlier about the law of Canada. The documents attached to the petition for return, which come through the central authority, are admitted into evidence with no further foundation necessary. So that law of Canada was before the trial court. The issue of Mr. Khan's I'm watching for the lights here. Okay.
You'll have time.
The issue of Mr. Khan's abandoning the child in India turns all those facts on their head. He had been ordered to turn the child over to Ms. Fatima, which he did. He had airline tickets, as did the entire family, for return on the 26th
That's
of April.
Fine. I don't accept that part of your opponent's argument. I don't think he's to be faulted for returning from India. I'm just concerned that I don't really see a procedurally adequate hearing by the district judge.
Ms. Sorth, haven't we told district judges time after time that they're required to use the most expeditious procedures available for these kinds of cases?
Absolutely.
That's what the Hague Convention provides?
Right. Then the
so
Hague
it's
itself,
like a TRO or a preliminary injunction?
Yes, the Hague itself says.
The hearings are findings are often oral and somewhat informal.
That's right.
Let me ask you, if I could, about something that troubles me on your side of the case. It has to do with the initial seizure of this child by marshals at about 6 in the morning. That was done on the basis of an ex parte submission, correct?
That's right.
Alleging risk of flight.
Flight
correct?
Risk, that's right.
Because
right.
India is not a signatory to the Hague Convention.
That's right.
I'm very troubled by that. First of all, the idea of officers coming in at 6 in the morning, I assume all of us can appreciate how traumatic that situation can be. It's what we usually run into with drug dealers. But in this case, I don't understand why simply seizing the passports of the mother and the child would not have been sufficient to prevent flight until you could get in front of the district judge where she has an opportunity to be heard.
The listing of Ms. Tarfa Fatima as a flight risk came through the Canadian materials from the Alberta Central Authority. Mr. Khan knew that she had fled from home once before and had come to her parents' home in Bolingbrook. When they were in India, for the period of time between the time that he was ordered to turn the child over until after a series of mediation sessions, following which she disappeared with the child, he had no idea where she was. Those actions in India effectively deprived him of the child for 11 months, no matter how he tried to keep communication with her.
I'm talking here about the ex parte seizure of the child, a change in the status quo without any hearing at which the mother's side could be heard, when it would seem to me there's a much less drastic method available to prevent flight until that fair hearing could be held.
Well, that is, you know, that would have been a possibility. The reason that we used the marshals to pick up the child was that she was a flight risk, and certainly
not without her passport.
Well, also, Mr. Khan had not seen his child for 11 months. And he
That's
had
not an excuse for doing things ex parte. That's sort of the flip side of this whole argument, right? Your whole point is that the mother unilaterally took the child.
That's right.
Here you got a court order to take the child back, but without her having an opportunity to be heard.
Well, I cannot tell you an answer as to why the passport picking
I
up her passport.
You asked for it. Mm-hmm.
Pardon?
You asked for the pickup of the child, right?
That's right.
Why did she split from her husband?
Well, her contentions are that.
Why do you think she did?
Well, I think that probably this arranged marriage should never have been, that they were not compatible people.
Well, that's true of about 50% of the Americans.
That's right, which sort of supports the point.
Counsel, could we go back for a moment to the point about efforts to find the child? It's not as though this was a deep, dark secret, right, that she was with her parents in Illinois for 11 months?
He did not know where she was, literally.
How hard was he trying?
But, Your Honor, under the Hague Convention, it doesn't make any difference whether he knows where they are or not. If you look at the convention itself and at the cases that are brought under the Hague Convention, whether he knows their location does not matter.
Well, 5 years later, if it were 5 years, that wouldn't matter?
Well, you only have a year to file your Hague Convention request, and it's within that period of time that whether he knows where they are or not is not a factor that the Hague takes into consideration. And if you'll remember, he communicated with her twice a week during that entire time, asking about the children, how they were doing, how she was doing, without one word of criticism or rage or threats or anything approaching anger during that entire period of time, which all goes to sort of defeat this impression that Mr. Giglio would like to give you, that he was a man filled with rage.
Well, that was what lay behind my question about why she split from him. She's not well off financially. She doesn't have good English, I gather. These arranged marriages are extremely common among Indians, and they're generally successful. And I would think she would have had to be kind of desperate to want to leave and have the responsibility for these children when she doesn't have good employment opportunities and doesn't speak English very well, even though she's a citizen. So isn't that very consistent with the fact that he is a person of ungovernable rage?
I do not agree with that at all.
Well, why do you think she split?
Basically because she was unhappy in this marriage. And
why,
I don't...
Why was she unhappy in the marriage? If you have an arranged marriage, your expectations of marital bliss, romantic love, and so on are going to be different from that of typical Western culture.
Your Honor, you're asking me to speculate about things that are not in the record at all.
Exactly.
And I cannot speculate about that.
Why
I
not?
Know,
don't you ever speculate?
Well, not in an appeal, no.
Okay. That's fine.
We usually try to discourage that.
Okay.
Speculation is confined to the five judiciaries.
Okay, well,
if I could just ask a follow-up. We heard from the mother's lawyer, but I'd like to hear your account of the current status of the Indian prosecution and the confession there.
All right. First of all, Mr. Khan denied that he ever confessed anything. The current status is that, as far as we know, that there is no prosecution going on. Remember that they took his passport, I'm finishing, and put him in jail overnight. He got bond. Everybody was gone. They kept his passport until the middle of July and then returned it to him, in effect saying, you can leave the country. He did not have his passport until approximately July 20th, and that was the date that he left. When they gave him his passport, it would seem to me, if you'll let me speculate, that they were not going to proceed with any action in India, no matter what the status of some document is.
There's an open file somewhere.
Maybe not. But they're certainly not keeping him there to continue the prosecution.
Okay, thank you, Mrs.
Seward.
Mr. Giglio, how much time does he have?
4 minutes. Okay.
Well, you don't have to use it all if you don't want to.
Tired of hearing from me already. With regard to the prosecution in India, the only certified documents that we have show that the prosecution is still pending and that the petitioner attempted to have the charges dismissed and that attempt was denied. There's absolutely no evidence to the contrary. With regard to this court choosing to either reverse outright and return the child to my client versus remand to cure the procedural and other errors that were committed, I would ask this court to outright reverse and return this child based upon two points. First, I believe that the petitioner's conduct specifically shows that he was not exercising custody, not just what he did in India, but other points, including no attempt to communicate with the child or with my client in India, failure to file his petition for 10 months, which is a specific factor that's been recognized, no attempts to reach out to the child at Bolingbrook, even though he had an address and he had a phone number, and he indicated on the stand that he had no intention of going to visit there, his failure to provide financial support, and his failure to request return of the child for over 9 months. Even the Facebook messages that he sent were innocuous. They were, how are things going? Was there, you know, is the child eating, et cetera? There's no request for a return, which would show his acquiescence as to where the child was.
How could we possibly reverse an order dismissal on the basis of the 13B defense?
Well, this is based on their failure to prove Article 3, not 13B.
You'd agree there's no basis for reversal on the 13B defense.
Well, under 13B, it's our burden to show clear and convincing that a grave risk exists. And while this court and most appellate courts are reluctant to overturn a trier of facts, findings of credibility, because they're in the best position to observe the witnesses, that's in stone.
There aren't any findings. I don't understand what there is to, what there is for an appellate court to.
Other than remand to have the hearing all over again. I think that the evidence that was presented, even on paper, of all the inconsistencies in the petitioner's testimony show that we met the burden.
Do you think we can find that as a matter of law on appeal?
Because there are inconsistencies in her testimony.
It's like a directed verdict in a criminal case, right?
Well,
for the government.
You have de novo review in this matter, where you can.
Not on factual matters.
Not on the factual matters.
We don't conduct a hearing.
I understand. I think that the errors committed, even in the. Well, I guess the lack of findings of the trial court, we kind of run into that barrier. But I think that to identify a couple of the errors in the trial court, the refusal to allow the expert to testify, and also refusing to allow the evaluation of the child. The evaluation of the child comes up in Canadian law in the AMRI case that we
pursued. How long has she been living with her father in a hotel in Chicago?
As far as we know, since... there's been a refusal to identify the actual address of where the petitioner is with the child.
How long has it been? I don't care what.
I believe since the March 9th, I believe, is the date when the law enforcement
went
out.
March 9th of this year.
Correct.
What about his optometry practice? Can he remain here indefinitely?
Well, there has been no evidence as far as the extent of that optometry practice put into the record. I mean, if I were to speculate, certainly that any prejudice with regard to his employment would pale in comparison to the harm to this child.
No. Look, he is an optometrist. Doesn't he have a job? How can you leave your job? It's 2 months already, almost 2 months. How can he be here for 2 months when he's an optometrist in Canada?
Well, the child could be placed with the mother pending the case, which would allow the petitioner to travel.
That's not my question. He's an optometrist. How does he take 2 months away from optometry to live in Chicago?
Tell him you don't know when you're done.
You may not know, obviously, but what's going on? Well, he's just going to live here indefinitely and drop his optometry practice? How does he feed himself?
Well, what I was trying to say, maybe I wasn't being clear, is that he could travel back and forth to attend to his practice during the proceedings if he didn't have to stay here with the child.
Look, you're not following me. How is it possible for him to be living in Chicago indefinitely when he's an optometrist in Canada?
Indefinitely would not be possible.
But he's actually living here and not just here on weekends and someone else taking care of the child. Is that right?
As far as I know, he's been here the entire time.
He's actually here. Okay, just curious. Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel.
Thank you.
And case will be taken under advisement. And the court will be in recess.